the studios of KPCW in Park City, you're listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. This morning, first we speak with journalist Mallory Tenori Tarpley about new insights into eating disorder treatment and why recovery from disordered eating continues to be such a uniquely challenging process. Then we hear from certified herbalist and author Rochelle Robinette about her new book, Naturally, The Herbalist's Guide to Health and Transformation. She'll discuss the historical importance and modern applications of the more than 80,000 medicinal plants in the world and talk about the new respect for herbalism as a complement to Western medicine. These guests, when we return, you're listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Stay with us. We'll be right back after these messages.
Back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. Today we're exploring a subject that touches countless individuals and families, often in silence. Eating disorders are among the most misunderstood and stigmatized mental health challenges. And in a world of resurging heroin chic, viral hashtag skinny talk trends and the Ozempic craze, the need for honest, hopeful conversation is more urgent than ever.
Joining us this morning is journalist and professor Mallory Tenori Tarpley. She's the author of a powerful new book called Slip, Life in the Middle of Eating Disorder Recovery. It's a beautifully written, deeply researched exploration of the complex realities of recovery. Slip is more than a book. It's an anchor for anyone navigating the turbulent waters of disordered eating, whether firsthand or alongside someone they love. Mallory, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
Maybe you could start by talking about the stages of eating disorder, because I feel like this is a lot about this middle ground. It's maybe saying that the recovery is way more nuanced and way more complex than we think.
Yes, definitely. So very often when we talk about eating disorders, there's a tendency to think about them in black and white terms, in that someone is either acutely sick or fully recovered. And certainly one can fully recover from an eating disorder, but we also know that recovery is ongoing for many people. And in some cases, eating disorders can be chronic. And yet we don't talk as much about what I call the middle place, which is this name that I've given to this liminal space between acute sickness and full recovery. And it's a space where I've lived out most of my adult life and where countless people who I interviewed also said that they live. And it's essentially a space where the eating disorder remains a vulnerability. And we know that this is the case for many individuals who have had an eating disorder or who still continue to struggle with the imprints of the disorder.
So interesting. You shed light on a lot of women or people in their 60s, their 70s, who maybe struggled with an eating disorder as a child, but in essence, they're still struggling with it. Maybe not displaying any active signs of eating disorder, but it's up here in the head, right?
Yes, because it is easy to think that one recovers from an eating disorder once they have restored their weight, for instance, or once they've gotten their behaviors under control. But so often there are these lingering cognitive aspects of eating disorders, which can really keep people stuck. And at times they can lead to relapse, because sometimes if you're constantly ruminating over your body and food, that can then end up leading to behavioral changes that could put you in a more difficult spot that may require more treatment.
Right. And eating disorder is different from some of the other maybe addictive behaviors or things that people are in recovery from, right? One of the things that always strikes me is just that there's this unique quality of giving other people a visual gauge of how someone in recovery is doing when they have an eating disorder. And sometimes even they think they're making a compliment. Oh, you look so thin, where that might actually be exactly at odds with, you know, your personal recovery. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. So yes, it is very easy to compliment people on the way that they look, because maybe you think that that's helping them in their recovery. I remember when I was in the very early stages of my recovery and I had gained weight in the hospital, family members and friends would say, well, you look so great. And in my mind, that was difficult to hear because I was so entrenched in wanting to be someone with anorexia and wanting to be skinny. And this was around age 13 when I was very much developing my identity. But so often we think that someone may be recovered just because they have gotten back up to a quote unquote healthy weight, but looks can be deceiving in that sense because they may still very much be struggling. And we also know that many people never end up becoming clinically underweight if they're struggling with a restrictive eating disorder. There's actually in the diagnostic manual of statistics, there's a diagnosis known as atypical anorexia, which essentially describes individuals who meet all of the diagnostic criteria for anorexia nervosa, except they're not clinically underweight. So we have to be really careful about making sure that we're not assuming that someone does or doesn't have an eating disorder simply based on the way that their body looks.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, also for most people in recovery, a major tool is avoidance of triggers, right? And people with alcohol use would avoid bars, alcohol use disorder, things like that. But we all have to eat. So how do you think that daily exposure to the challenges take place in an eating disordered mind, how does that change the recovery journey?
That is one of the really tricky parts about recovery from an eating disorder, is that we need food to survive and we are constantly having to make choices throughout the day about what to eat, what not to eat, how much to portion ourselves. And for those of us who have had lived experience with an eating disorder, that can be incredibly difficult. I would say it's sometimes difficult for anyone, but particularly if you have had these experiences of really not knowing how to properly feed yourself. And if you've struggled with that for many years, it can be really hard to know what's quote unquote normal when it comes to portion sizes or how much you should or shouldn't be eating. And so that can really be one of the factors that makes recovery so complicated, is that we can't abstain from food. We have to be surrounded by it. Most social events revolve around food. So it's something that we constantly have to contend with. And certainly the hope in recovery is that those choices around food become easier over time. I know that they have for me, but it's still something that I'm confronted with each day in terms of making choices that are really in service of recovery.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about food in every social gathering, of course, and it makes me think about those who are struggling with an alcohol addiction. There's been a tool kind of recently, I feel, it's that liquid death, that can that looks like you're drinking something alcoholic, but it's not. And I don't know if it was designed that way, but there are lots of non-alcoholic beers and things like that. But someone, you know, you can't fake not eating or eating certain things or trying to avoid a trigger. You just can't fake it. Can you take us through your own struggle? You were very young when you first sort of encountered yourself in the situation of having an eating disorder.
Yes. So I developed anorexia when I was 12 years old after my mother died of metastatic breast cancer. And for me, the development of the eating disorder was not about wanting to be skinny, but really wanting to be safe and small. So after my mother died, I tried to put on a happy face and tried to pretend I was okay, but inside I was really crumbling. And the more time passed, the farther away I felt from my mother. And I began to find myself wanting to stop time. And I had conjured up this idea as a 12-year-old that maybe if I stayed the same size I was when my mom was alive, I could somehow be closer to her. And at the same time, I was taking a seventh grade health class where we were learning about what foods we should and shouldn't eat and learning about what foods to avoid and what foods could make us gain weight. And as a perfectionist and overachiever, I said, well, I need to listen to my teacher's directives and I can only eat good foods. And I was beginning to learn in that class that I could change the way my body looked depending on what I put into it. So wanting to stay safe and small and stop time, and then learning about what food could do to the body really led me into this pattern of food restriction. And I didn't set out to develop an eating disorder, but within a matter of months, I had devolved into a full-fledged eating disorder and was officially diagnosed at age 13.
That is such a heartbreaking story. And it shows, it illuminates how different the stories are. Like, as you said, you didn't care about getting fat. You just wanted to stay young and little. You talked to over 700 people to write this book, Slip. And you must have heard just the stories that you could never have imagined. Can you share one or two with us?
Sure. So there were a lot of people who I interviewed because I wanted to expand the scope of this book beyond my own narrative. And I remember there was one young gentleman who I interviewed who had been discriminated against both because of his gender, but because of his body size. And he was struggling with atypical anorexia. So he was restricting his food intake, but he never became clinically underweight. And when he would try to seek medical help, he was often told, well, we don't know what the problem is, or it doesn't seem like you have an eating disorder. And it wasn't until he began to experience really sort of harmful side effects physically, like having multiple fainting episodes, that he was then able to get medical help for this eating disorder. But it took multiple tries for him to actually be able to get help. And I include this narrative in a part of the book where I talk about just the lack of medical training around eating disorders. So research shows that the average doctor gets 0 to 2 hours of training on eating disorders in med school and in residency, which is just mind-boggling when you think about how many people struggle. There was another person I interviewed who was the mother of a young girl who I actually was in treatment with years ago in the late 1990s, and her daughter had passed away due to the disorder. And it was just heartbreaking. I had tried to reconnect with her daughter in writing this book and then saw that she had passed. And I just really wanted to talk to her mother so that I could learn more about her daughter's story and also show in the book that she was more than her disorder, even though she lost her life to it. So that's a relatively grave story, and they're not all like that. I certainly have stories of people who are fully recovered in the book as well, but I do think it's also important to recognize that these disorders can take lives and really do need to be taken seriously.
If you're just joining us on the program, we're talking with Mallory Tenori Tarpley, author of a new book called Slip, Life in the Middle of Eating Disorder Recovery. I have family members who are in recovery for different things, and so I'm a little more up on some of the terminology than some folks might be. But could you tell our listeners a little bit about the distinction between the term slip and relapse, or other phrases that we've come to associate with the recovery process?
Yes. And I'm really glad you asked that, because for a long time, the word slip has been stigmatized in the eating disorder field. And it was a big part of why I wanted to title the book Slip, because slips are so common, but they're not talked about enough. And they're not really thought of as something that can happen in an ongoing capacity. Usually when we think of slips, we think, well, they're just sort of, you know, temporary. They only happen when you're leaving treatment and when you are about to become fully recovered. But many of us struggle with these slips throughout our lives. And slips are really blips in the road to recovery. So they are common and inevitable. And yet, again, they're often stigmatized in a field that really pushes for full recovery without a consensus definition of what full recovery actually means. So slips tend to occur when someone is trying to make meaningful progress, because I always like to say that you can't slip if you're standing still. So often when we're working forward and moving forward in recovery, we inevitably slip because we're doing hard things. And the goal really in recovery is to recognize the slip and learn from it so that it doesn't lead to an uncontrollable slide or relapse. When we talk about relapses, that's really more of a repetitive pattern of eating disorder thoughts and behaviors without an ability to get back on track. And so oftentimes those relapses may end up leading to the need for a higher level of treatment or care.
Sure, that makes sense. Well, also in the subtitle of the book, Life in the Middle of Eating Disorder Recovery, feels like an important distinction. What might people who haven't been in recovery not understand about that trajectory of beginnings, endings, full recovery, or just full life practice? How does that definition evolve for you?
Yes. So for me, it was really helpful to just think about this framework for recovery, because for a long time, I tried to achieve the gold standard of full recovery. But it always seemed like a perfectionistic ideal to me. And if you look at the research, there are about as many definitions of full recovery from an eating disorder as there are studies about it. So it's no wonder that people with lived experience can get confused by that, particularly too, because we live in a culture that is steeped in fat phobia and diet culture. So it's really hard to know what does full recovery even look like in a society like ours. So when I surveyed and interviewed all those hundreds of people, of the 700 plus survey respondents, 85% of them said they could identify with this middle place. And many of them said, this is giving me language to describe my recovery in ways that I couldn't before. And so part of this is about expanding the language that we use to describe recovery so that we can take more inclusive approaches to healing. But it's also recognizing that when we only think about recovery in terms of its fullest form, it can make many of us who aren't fully recovered feel ashamed anytime we slip. And so the middle place is really about recognizing that slips happen, but not seeing those as grounds for failure, but rather opportunities for growth. And so it's a matter of really reframing or thinking around recovery and allowing ourselves more grace if we end up inhabiting this middle place, whether it be for just a couple years or for most of our lives. So it's important to recognize the people in this space, because for so long, this space has been overlooked. And yet from doing all this research for the book, I know that it's a quite populous space.
I hope this isn't too personal of a question, but I'm wondering what a slip looks like for you, and what, and or if you don't have slips, which it's kind of sounding like everyone does, what are the thoughts and what are the triggers for you that occur? It's, you know, life has really moved on for you. I don't know how old you are, but you're very far from the 12-year-old girl.
Yes, yes. I actually just turned 40, which is symbolic because my mom passed away when she was 40. So it feels really significant to be putting this book out into the world at this moment in time when I'm outliving her. But for me, I find that my slips often happen when I am just feeling overwhelmed and when I'm feeling like I don't have much control over my schedule, for instance, or I don't feel like I really have any time for myself and I'm just constantly working and taking care of my children. And so in those instances, I find that my first instinct is to restrict my food intake. And that has just always been my sort of go-to coping mechanism. Over the years, I've learned not to listen to that voice that tells me you should restrict. But there are times sometimes when I do, right? So I may end up just not having enough to eat for a particular meal. Whereas in the past, I would sort of just continue down that path of restriction. If I notice, for instance, that I've not had nearly enough at lunch, then I say, okay, why was that? What happened? Who can I talk to about that, whether it's my partner or someone else? And how can I make sure that I get back on track, right? How do I make sure I have a nourishing dinner, for instance, things like that. Sometimes it also creeps up with regard to exercise, because I did struggle with obsessive compulsive disorder when I was acutely sick as a teenager. And that's a very common comorbidity for eating disorders. So at times I find myself trying to run really fast, even though I haven't gotten enough sleep or haven't had enough to eat. And so part of my recovery has been also recognizing, okay, how do I figure out how to slow down, right? So a slip might happen if I go for that really far and fast run. And the recovery sort of oriented choice is to the next day say, okay, let me slow down. Let me go for a walk, or maybe I don't need to exercise at all today. So I'm constantly thinking through those slips anytime I have them so that I can make sure that they don't turn into a slide, but that they really become these opportunities for growth in my recovery.
Okay, very interesting. Because you're talking about this middle ground, and you interviewed a lot of people who are later in life who are no doubt experiencing some of the health issues that maybe were created from having an eating disorder when they were younger. Can you talk a little bit about that? And does that present itself like a trigger?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so we do know that there can be many residual side effects that do occur from these eating disorders. One of them for sure is just bone density loss. And that is something that we can't really reverse. So particularly for individuals who struggled when they were adolescents, that can be something that really follows them throughout their lives, where they may end up with osteopenia or osteoporosis as a result. Fortunately, in my own experiences, I was able to get treatment early on and do not have any of those residual side effects. But we also know that there can be instances where our body goes through life transitions. Menopause, for instance, is a big one. And our body size may change during that period. We may also get recommendations for weight loss or for other things that could be really triggering for us in middle age. So it's really important to recognize these moments that could potentially be triggering, particularly if they are transitions that are related to bodily changes. And those are moments for those of us in recovery to really be cognizant of, so that we can make sure we have enough support so we can successfully navigate those difficult periods.
There may be people listening to the show today who are experiencing eating disorders and don't even really know that or recognize that about themselves. Are there any unexpected signs or things that you might encourage somebody to notice about their own behaviors that might encourage them to get treatment?
Yeah, so one of the big ones is actually isolation. Many people struggling with eating disorders will isolate themselves and they will stop socializing, partly because so many social events do revolve around food and that can feel quite overwhelming. So if you find that you're isolating yourself, if you're retreating inward, also if you find that you are not seeking pleasure from foods in the ways that you once did, so maybe you are really just kind of moving away from foods that you once loved, that can be a sign that you are letting disordered thoughts really dictate your eating, as opposed to allowing yourself to eat foods that you may have once really enjoyed. Also too, certainly if you're noticing that you are having bodily changes, whether that's weight gain or weight loss, if you're having side effects like fainting episodes or really lack of energy and constant fatigue, all of those physical signs too are important to recognize. And we know that eating disorders are disorders of both the body and the mind. So certainly there are these physical changes that can occur, but a big part of this too is how much mental space is the eating disorder potentially taking up, or how much space are these thoughts around food and body size taking up. If it seems like they're taking up the majority of your mental space, that can be a real sign that you may end up having an eating disorder. And the earlier someone receives treatment, the better the prognosis. And many people struggle silently for years and never end up getting help. So it's really important to recognize how crucial that help is, whether it's you who needs help or whether it's someone who you love needs that help.
If you could go back in time and give an earlier version of yourself your best advice from where you are now, what would you tell yourself?
I love that question. So the first thing that comes to mind is I would tell myself that I was special and worthy of being loved and cared for without my eating disorder. I for so long thought that my eating disorder made me special, and it was really what gave me a lot of care and attention after my mother died, but it was not the right kind of care and attention. But I just was so deeply ingrained in wanting to have the identity of someone with an eating disorder that I really lost my sense of self, and I stopped socializing. I stopped doing the things that I once loved. And the eating disorder really came to define me. So I wish that I could go back and tell myself, you are so much more than your disorder, and you have so much more to live for. And you will always be special, especially in recovery.
That's big. It's really big. Since in the introduction, we mentioned things like Ozempic and this heroin chic, all of that. I mean, on the one hand, I feel like to a certain degree, we're getting a handle on, you know, not thinking that skinny is beautiful and, you know, and really embracing robustness and being muscular and not needing to be skinny. On the other hand, there are these factors at play right now in our pop culture that are stressing being skinny. How is all that affecting the whole world of an eating disorder?
Yeah, so for a while we were more of the mindset that that there was a lot of body positivity and we should love and respect our bodies. But now the pendulum has swung in the other direction, where now we are back in this mentality of thin is in and the thin ideal is best. And that pendulum is always swinging back and forth, and it has throughout time. But particularly for those who have an eating disorder or have had one in the past or who are predisposed to developing one, these messages around weight loss can be quite triggering. And we see these messages all the time. I was even streaming a movie the other day with my kids on Disney Plus, and we saw these ads for GLP-1s. And so this messaging is really hard to avoid. It can certainly be triggering for those with eating disorders. And there's been some new stories coming out looking at the fact that some individuals who've had eating disorders in the past are still getting prescribed these drugs. And so that can be especially difficult because, again, it goes back to just the more systemic issue of doctors really not getting trained in eating disorders. And so we therefore have instances in which people who are being prescribed these disorders are not sort of being asked about prior medical history related to an eating disorder. And so these can be really difficult, even for people who are more firmly rooted in their recovery. I've heard stories from people struggling with diabetes who are fully recovered from an eating disorder, but they're on these drugs and finding them to be quite triggering. So it's something we have to be talking more about.
Wow. This is a really illuminating conversation. I have to say I'm sure you encounter this. People who have never experienced an eating disorder just have zero idea of what it's like. Even a lot of the, you know, like Mary Beth said, a lot of the words surrounding it. And this has been a great education. Mallory Tenori-Tarpley is our guest, and her book is Slip, Life in the Middle of Eating Disorder Recovery. Mallory, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. According to our next guest, herbalist Rochelle Robinette, there are 30,000 medicinal plants in use in the world today, 80,000 plants that are edible, and 2,000 new plants are discovered every year. Today, Rochelle joins the show to talk about how modern herbalism, the science and art of plants as medicine, can be used to complement Western medicine.
Rochelle has created a whole network that includes coaching, writing, a podcast, and now a new book called Naturally, The Herbalist's Guide to Health and Transformation, which is the ultimate beginner-friendly guide to herbalism, which helps us incorporate plants into our existing routines for better gut health, sleep, sex, focus, and more. Rochelle, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here.
You know, I have to say that when I think of herbalism, I think of maybe something that existed in the past where you would walk into these old stores that, like an old style apothecary that smelled, you know, of all these different herbs and concoctions. And it never felt like something very intuitively, you know, friendly, but you are practicing something that you call modern herbalism. And so I'm wondering how you make that distinction.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I love those stores. I love apothecaries. I grew up going to health food stores and the scent is distinct. You're right. you know, it's the same practice. It's the same lifestyle. Herbalism is herbalism. But something that I have been intent on sharing from the beginning is that herbalism doesn't have to look like an apothecary. It doesn't have to smell like a health food store. It can work with modern lives. And, you know, I lived that and practiced that for over a decade in New York City, you know, even while I was working in fashion. And what I would say is that it's the same mentality, you know, it's the same ingredients, but I love to show people that it is so well suited to modern life. And it's often what so many people are looking for, even though they don't realize that that's what they're looking for.
Right. Well, when you talk about 80,000 plants that are edible, it's, you know, we ought to be looking for the medicinal values in the foods that we eat. And I was just curious about in amongst those 80,000 plants. I think kale is very medicinal. If I eat enough kale, I'm going to be pretty healthy. So what is included in these 80,000 plants? Are these plants that we're regularly eating every day?
Some of them, yes. And kale is absolutely included, you know, and our nutrition is our first medicine. It always has been. It probably always will be. All herbalists will also work with diet and nutrition and probably first, you know, and that's one of the reasons why I love herbalism. It's not just plants as medicine. It is nutrition and fitness and mental health and community and exposure to nature broadly. But in terms of edible plants, yes, kale, I mean, blueberries are considered an herb in herbalism. You know, hawthorn, elderberry. Elderberry is a perfect example of something that's edible and also highly medicinal. All of the herbs and spices that we might cook with, you know, turmeric or basil or cilantro, thyme, oregano, all of these are foods and they are also, you know, quote unquote herbs that are used medicinally. So as we know, variety is ideal in our diet and a large degree of, you know, plants and produce in our diet is ideal. And all of that is considered medicinal, definitely.
And in your book, you talk about bridging that gap between the natural and the Western medical world. And I think that's so interesting because really, aren't almost all of our medicines in some way have a derivative of a natural source? And yes, we can make them synthetic, we can create things, but it's pretty astonishing how much is already based on the natural world. Is that right?
That's definitely right. I think it's 80%, give or take, of the, you know, current medications came from or come from plants originally, you know, anesthesia, aspirin, all of these things. So, you know, herbalism, it's new to many, many people now, but herbalism predates modern medicine. It predates the wellness industry. You know, it was something that we were all practicing and living, you know, in our past, in our lineages, and even animals practice herbalism. A lot of herbalism has been learned from observing animals working with these plants. Mm. And I do really like to, I like to show the science that's associated with it as well. And I think for people who are interested in some of the more modern either medications or supplements or biohacks or these sorts of things, I love to show that herbalism, it works right in there with all of that stuff too. You know, it is scientifically validated. There are a lot of studies in my book. I mean, every claim essentially has a reference or four to back it up, because I think that really does kind of pull it into the present day and show that like modern science today is validating the efficacy of things in herbalism that have been practiced for thousands of years.
I also find it's interesting how, at least in my understanding, that the herbalism world has largely been driven by women in kind of tribal environments. It seemed like the women were the keeper of this information. Frequently, perhaps the males were out hunting and the women were gathering and holding on to this knowledge and passing it down. Do you feel like you have a special role for women, even though this could help everybody as a modern herbalist?
That's a beautiful question. I haven't been asked that ever before. I love it. And you're very right. You know, a lot of people, you know, who might be familiar with herbalism, they say, oh, That's what my grandmother used to do. You know, that's that concoction she used to brew when we were sick, or that balm she used to create from ingredients in the garden to rub on our skin when we were sunburned or had a rash. You know, what I would say in response to that is that I often in this work feel like a medium for the message, you know, whether or not I'm a woman. You know, I feel like what I am doing and what I, you know, all I need to do is share this information as clearly as possible, make it as accessible and practical as possible. And people, their lives change, their eyes light up, they get it. Like we know this inherently. And so often, you know, I feel like I just have to get the message out. And the truth of herbalism, the sort of inherent understanding that we all have about the rightness of this for our lives, like it just carries it the rest of the way.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Rochelle Robinette. She is an herbalist and she has a new book out called Naturally, The Herbalist's Guide to Health and Transformation. The world of herbalism can seem quite daunting and large, but you say just start with one thing. You're talking to someone at a party and they say, "Okay, Rochelle, what is that one thing? I want to start with one thing to make it easy for myself."
For most people, that is tea, I would say. And it's one thing and it's one plant, you know, so it sort of depends. If you know no herbs, then I would encourage getting to know one. Probably one that grows in your area, one you might see at the farmer's market, one you might see at the park or in your backyard, one you might see as a common ingredient at restaurants or, you know, coffee shops or these sorts of things at the grocery store. Getting to know one plant at a time. If you already know some plants and you're looking for that next step to incorporate more herbal medicine, if you will, into your life, then it's definitely one step at a time. So it could be drinking a cup of tea each day, which involves making it, which is also a practice that is therapeutic and medicinal, you know, brewing tea. It could, you know, even easier for a lot of people is to find a blend in capsule form. You know, if someone says, "I am not a tea person, I don't have the time for that, I'm not going to do it," that's okay. Then you can use a capsule, you know, take it with your probiotics in the morning or whatever other supplements you might be taking through the day. It's a little bit more removed, you know, you don't see the color, you don't smell it, you don't taste it, you're not really connecting with the organic material that this medicine came from. But if that's what's going to be the first step that works for you, then that is the right step for you, you know, and we can do it one at a time. And that's how I've always practiced, you know, if it's incorporating herbalism into a life or changing diet or changing a routine or managing stress, we really, you know, I believe that we really need to just make one change at a time until it becomes part of our routine, part of our lifestyle, and then we can add on another. And that leads to, you know, transformation ultimately, if we want it. I've seen it hundreds, thousands of times at this point. It's really incredible.
You break up the categories into nine different categories of types of herbs. And you start at the top with the herbs for the nervous system. How do you pronounce that? Nervines or nervines?
Nervines. Yeah, it's pronounced both ways. I say nervines.
Okay. So what might be an example of a nervine and what is it going to do? I always think of herbs as being very subtle. And nuanced the effects, you know, where we're used to, oh, take an ibuprofen and then in an hour you won't have that pain anymore. Is something for the nervous system going to be nuanced and subtle?
Well, nuanced is a perfect way to describe herbs. They work in such a wide variety of ways, and that's ideal because they generally help to balance our system, our body, and to help improve our natural processes. That said, there are plenty of herbs that are not subtle. Coffee is one, you know. Valerian is not a particularly subtle herb. Kava is not a particularly subtle herb. So there are subtle herbs and there are much stronger ones, especially when you get into the range of sort of psychedelics and these things. You know, those are about as far from subtle as it gets. But nervines are herbs that work specifically on the nervous system, and they generally work in two primary ways. One is to help calm us down. So chamomile, lavender, lemon balm, rose, motherwort, valerian, California poppy, hops. Some of the best known herbs, I would say, just generally are nervines. And they range from being calming, like lavender and chamomile, to more sedative, like valerian and hops, California poppy. So we can use them for just general balance during the day. You know, for example, the lavender is a beautiful plant for that. Or if we have trouble sleeping or we're really anxious and we want something that will calm us down quite quickly, we can use some of those more sedative plants. And the other way that some of the nervines work, that many of the nervines work, is to heal actual physical nerves. So if there's any sort of nerve damage in the body, we can use plants like St. John's wort or lion's mane mushroom to help rehabilitate physical nerve health. Another really beautiful nervine that works more over the long term is oat. So the oat plant, and we use the milky oat tops from that plant. And those are sort of a food for the nervous system. They're excellent for preventing or recovering from burnout.
Well, you mentioned some of the relaxing or sedative plants. I'll tell you a really funny quick story. Is years ago, my husband and I were in France, and we were near Gourdes, which is this area where there's a lot of lavender fields, and we saw like a lavender place where they make the essential oils and everything. And we're like, oh, let's go check it out. So we go, and at the end of the tour, they let us put our hands underneath this water, which was just infused with all this lavender, and it was kind of the wastewater from the essential oils, and it just was pouring over just a ton of it all over our hands. We're like, oh, well, that was real nice. And Mark and I both were open to stuff, you know, modern things, but I don't know that we were big believers in like essential oils. And we got in the car, we drove about 5 minutes up to the little village where we were going to visit, and it started raining. So we sat in the car for a minute, we rolled up the windows, and we both woke up an hour and 15 minutes late. And it totally changed my tune about the actual efficacy of some plant-based things, because I just thought some of it is maybe that some of it I maybe at the time I just believed it was like positive thinking, you know, like if I believe this is going to do it, like psychosomatically, it's going to help me. And maybe that is part of it, but there was an absolute physiological response. And so, what do you think? Because I'm seeing much more credibility attached to herbalism these days. What do you associate with that credibility? Is it just more vigorous or rigorous studies, or just more people discovering that it actually works?
That's a great story. And I mean, positive thinking and the placebo, you know, placebo is the most powerful medicine that we have still. So there's that. But I mean, that's something, you know, I think again from day one, and something that I do in the book is describe exactly how these plants are affecting us. You know, on a functional level, they're modifying, you know, levels of neurotransmitters in our brain. They're adjusting hormone levels. They're changing our gut bacteria or the way our muscles are working. I mean, so it's very possible, and science has identified often that herbs work and some of the ways that they work, but they work in so many ways that our modern system for kind of doing research on these things is almost too specific. It's too narrowly focused to capture the breadth of the way that these herbs work. And I think one example of that is ashwagandha. And this is an herb that's categorized as an adaptogen. It's a calming adaptogen. It's great for stress resilience, muscle tone and strength, fertility, immunity, lots of things. But in terms of its stress, its action on stress, it helps to normalize cortisol levels. And that concept is a little bit different than what we see in Western medicine, which is generally we take a drug to raise something or we take a drug to lower something. We don't take a drug that kind of assesses the state of our body and generally works it toward homeostasis and said, oh, you know, and says, oh, cortisol is too high, we'll bring it down. If cortisol is too low, we'll bring it up. You know, so this nuanced, as you said, way that plants work and the fact that they can sometimes have hundreds of active compounds in a single plant, make them fascinating, make them definitely effective, and make them also a challenge to study. So there isn't a lot of question about whether or not they work, but we don't always know exactly the mechanisms of action. And I talk about mechanisms of action in the book as well, because, like I said, I like that level of detail when I'm understanding why an herb is affecting me or someone else.
I think maybe it was Andrew Weil or Deepak Chopra 15 years ago helped introduce people to the idea of adaptogens. And one that I use regularly is rhodiola. I find it is so wonderful for energy. And like you said, I think most Western medicine, it does one specific thing. And if they can, they find a way to patent it. So you have to take it every day to do that one specific thing. And the nice thing about herbal medicine is that it's much more holistic and it might be more subtle, it might be dramatic, as you mentioned in some of the earlier examples, but that's such an interesting part of it that something could bring you up, could bring you down, could even you out. And like it almost seems impossible. It's hard for us to wrap our minds around that. So what I'm wondering is, I think about TikTok trends like med talk or whatever, and things are trendy sometimes. Like you'll hear all about turmeric and pepperine, or you'll hear all about the latest, greatest thing. How can we be smart consumers and stewards of our bodies and navigate the nutritional industrial complex in a way that's positive for everybody?
Yeah, great question. I can also speak to the latter part of your previous question, which is, why is there more and more sort of awareness of the fact that herbalism exists and herbalism works? Herbalism has always existed. And of course, the wellness industry is an enormous part of that. And the wellness industry, of course, is, all over social media and driving a lot of those trends. I always recommend that, we're welcome to consume the media of those trends, but when it comes to our health, it is always more productive for us to start by reflecting inward as opposed to, acting based on whatever is trending in the industry. There are so many reasons why things trend in the industry, and not very many of them are compelling for us to, then follow them. What we need personally, what do we know we need? What are we trying to change in our lives or about our health? What are we interested in? That sort of thing. When we start from that place, we can then go seek and find the remedies that are right for us. I think otherwise, what happens, or what I found, is otherwise we're hopping from trend to trend because there will always be another one. It becomes fad-ish, just like I think we have less fad diets now, less sort of, crash diets and these sorts of things, and much more of the fad wellness trends. We can waste a lot of time, a lot of money, become frustrated, get a little lost on the way, maybe have some fun as well. I'm not opposed to, the trends and playing and experimenting. But really, that act of personal reflection, self-awareness, not only is it going to lead us into the direction that, we need to go or we want to go ultimately, but that act itself is also medicinal. And the more we can practice listening to our bodies and understanding what the symptoms are saying, and then going below the symptoms and trying to identify the causes of those symptoms, the better we are going to be able to navigate our own health and care for ourselves and others.
I know that you engage in coaching people on kind of finding what's right for them. If you were to visit Park City and see Mary Beth and me, for example, what would be sort of that coaching experience to get us to realize what's right for our bodies?
Yeah, so I've coached hundreds, maybe thousands of people at this point, and I don't actively see clients anymore. But by the end of that sort of phase of my practice, there were so many themes that were very, very clear among all of us as individuals. And one of them is sort of that point that I just mentioned. The need to sort of turn off the noise for a minute and just spend some time with ourselves and our bodies and our lives. So generally what happens is I, like probably any other herbalist, will take a very thorough picture of your health, a very thorough intake. What is your daily diet like? How much are you moving? How are you sleeping? How is your mental health? How is your stress balance? How much time are you getting outside? Everything, you know? And sometimes, you know, sometimes the process resembles therapy, because we might be working in that space of, you know, the right thing to do, but you're not doing it. Why do we think that is? That's a very fruitful place to work. And sometimes that's where we need to work, as opposed to just saying, you have headaches, here's an herb for your headaches. No great herbalist is going to do that. We're going to say, you have headaches? Okay, let's explore that. Why might you have headaches? And if they're coming from any of these other things that have nothing to do with herbs, let's work on those first. We can give you some herbs to help with the pain. Maybe we give you some herbs to help with hormone balance if that's causing the headaches, or liver support so that can improve hormone balance. You know, so it's very holistic. It's holistic. It is always personalized. And we work wherever we need to work, usually with the gentlest effective medicine first. And that can often be diet changes or sleep adjustments or something like that. You know, there's this phrase that I really love that comes from David Winston, one of my favorite herbalists and teachers. And he said, you know, we don't treat diseases, we treat people. It is always that personalized. And that's what we need. That's a beautiful thing.
After you said that so beautifully, I'm going to ask you a not very holistic question.
Okay, I'm ready.
Our guests can't see you, but we can, and you have the most beautiful and perfect skin. Please tell us what we can take for that.
I love it. Well, thank you very much. It's funny, that question led me into herbalism, because the story is in the book, because I have been asked that question so many times in my life. And long story short, you can read it in the book, but someone essentially said, what is your skincare routine? And I was like, I eat raw food and drink a lot of weird teas. And, you know, I was sober and vegan at the time. And I probably just used moisturizer. Like, I didn't have a skincare routine. My skincare routine was my lifestyle, you know? So
yeah,
I do love skincare, but given the fact that so many people have asked me that over the course of my life, and that I've been living this way for essentially my whole life, I have to say it's the plants.
Yeah. Well, it's
from within, you know, it's really, yeah. Our skin is such a reflection of our internal environment.
Well, that is a very holistic answer to a not holistic question. So, well, the book is Naturally, the Herbalist's Guide to Health and Transformation. And wow, that last answer was a very good reason to look up your book. Rochelle Robinette is our guest. She's a registered herbalist and now the author of this book, Naturally. Rochelle, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab, or on the KPCW app, or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW The Mountain Life. And if you like today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.